From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Are you starting to get your garden thoughts together? Today on the show, we'll discuss the importance of knowing where your seeds come from. Spring weather has us headed outside. Hear ideas for perfect picnic food. Are we living in a foodopoly? A journalist investigates how 20 companies came to control almost all of the food we eat. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery to find out what's in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Spring is finally here and the weather is warming up and we are looking for new seasonal specialties to appear at the market. Everybody's been waiting and looking for English peas, snap peas, and I know that they grow throughout the year at various times. However, we seem to be sort of pea crazy right now. I'm talking with Richard Sager, who has a stand called Two Peas in a Pod. Richard, today you have both English shelling peas and snap peas. So can you describe the difference and explain what you have here today?
Well, the snap pea, the whole pod is edible, so there's no waste to it. And the English pea, you just eat the peas. But a lot of people are addicted to them because they've had them since they were young. Kind of a seasonal thing, too, in the springtime.
So how long have you had these English peas in here?
Well, this is my first week.
Okay, and are they on time? Are they late? Are they early?
We're always late. Everybody else has them before us. We always have them late. And we have them till it gets too hot, they won't produce.
So middle of the summer, they'll just kind of fade away. And the difference on the outside is not that apparent. And I think some people sometimes get confused and they'll try to eat a whole English pea with the tough pod. How do you describe them to people?
Usually the size of the English pea is really large, except for there's other varieties that are smaller. But this variety is mildew resistant. That's the reason we grow it. You don't have to spray it with anything. And you can see on the top of it, the string has a string and it's easier to open, where you don't have as much string on a snap pea. And the thing about it is a lot of times you'll see a little mark on the side where a bird's been pecking.
Yeah.
And they want to see if there's something in there.
Right.
They can tell.
Well, so then on the English peas, they are super big right now. Are they going to keep getting bigger and bigger, and then they get tougher as they get bigger?
This is a variety that we grow. It's called Mr. Big. They're the largest variety, and they just don't last when it gets real hot. That's the only problem.
And when I bring them home, do I want to just leave them in the pod for a while before I cook them?
You do. They should be cooked within a few days. They get starchy, where snap peas stay sweet for weeks.
And you've got the snap peas, too?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So it's a good time for peas, and these are great for soups, salad, and, of course, you can eat them raw or cooked.
Yeah.
That was Richard Sager. He's the farmer at Two Peas in a Pod. Not only does he have the sugar snaps and the English peas, he also has those wonderful selection of beans. We have a visitor today who literally got off a plane an hour ago after flying nonstop from Israel overnight. His name is Asaf Grenit. He may not be familiar to customers here, but he's very well known in his hometown of Jerusalem. He owns 4 restaurants. He's going to be opening another restaurant soon in London. And Asaf, you're here. You're going to be preparing a special dinner tonight with Suzanne Tracht at Jar. You're shopping at the market. Tell us what your menu ideas are and how you've been able to adjust or adapt once you've been here at the market.
To begin, I'll have to say that I'm blown away by the products in this market. Everything looks so fresh and so unique because my restaurant is inside the biggest market in Israel. So we have some unique stuff and, of course, fresh every day, but it's mainly mass quantities and not stuff so special. Like a minute ago, I tasted the blood orange that blew me away. So tasty, and everything looks hand-picked. So it's nice for me to see, and my mind starts working about the menu.
So you formulate the menu. You're literally doing that based on what you see at the market while you're shopping?
Yeah, my restaurant, the whole idea was opening a restaurant inside the market. So every day we go, me and my partners, or the sous chefs will go to the market, look what's in season, and then we'll get the fish from over there, and we get the meat from over there, and everything, and we combine maybe not 100% new menu every day, but everything changes as long as the season is changing.
So, for example, what are you cooking with now in Jerusalem?
Now would be the few weeks after Passover, which is for us the best season for chefs in Israel, because you got lots of stuff that grows in Israel only now, like fresh fava beans, fresh chickpea, fresh snow peas, all the green stuff now in Israel, and the fish now is really producing nicely. And then you got, because it's a big holiday, so the market is full of people from all the chefs and grandmas and everybody. And so it's the best time of the year for us. It's really eye-opening.
Well, we do share that Mediterranean climate. They say in California we're very similar to that part of the world. So do you have local farms that come into the market around your restaurant?
We do. We have a few farms. Most of the products come directly to the market. They don't sell it everyone uniquely. And then we got mainly more goat farms and lots of goat cheese and less with the vegetables, but it's now growing. There's a big farmer's market in Tel Aviv that made the farmer's market much more hyped now in Israel, so people are getting into it. Till now, farmers were more of mass producing and not about the quality, and it's changing to that direction, and it's moving on. Yeah.
So glad you're enjoying yourself here at the market.
Thanks a lot.
That was Asaf Grenit. He is a chef owner of 4 restaurants in Jerusalem, opening a new one in London, and has the largest restaurant in Jerusalem that's actually a restaurant inside a market. He'll be cooking tonight at Jar with owner Suzanne Tracht, and they'll be preparing a special meal based on farmers market ingredients. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
KCRW thanks the Flora L. Thornton Foundation for its support of good food. People who don't live here in Southern California love to talk about how we Angelenos don't have any seasons. But those of us who live here would tell you differently. We do. For instance, picnic season is just beginning here. That means that our winter rains have gone away and daytime temperatures are starting to warm up so we can hike in the canyons. But what should you take to eat on your next jaunt to the beach or a hike in Topanga? Kate Perutz has some ideas. She lives in London where she writes the blog The Saturday Picnic Society. I asked Kate for some ideas on what to pack for our next day hike.
Well, I mean, it really depends on how much walking you're doing to get where you're going. Kind of determines how hungry you are. And where you're going, of course. So in L.A., obviously, you have the beach. So for that kind of thing, I'd love to pack something like lettuce wraps. So you could kind of make a salad to go in the middle of lettuce leaves. Something maybe like shredded duck and watermelon and hoisin sauce, maybe cashews. Whereas if you were going somewhere like the desert or the mountains, you'd want to take something a bit more substantial. So maybe I did some wraps with miso and tahini and roasted chicken last weekend. I think something like that would be delicious to take up into the mountains.
Now, I'm curious, what kind of equipment do you take? You know, it's funny. I found recently this 60-year-old gorgeous vintage picnic basket, but I can't really imagine myself carrying it anywhere. Do you just throw everything in a backpack?
That's exactly what I do. And you know what? To be honest, it's not even a very big backpack because you don't want to have to carry that much stuff if you're walking for a while. Sandwiches, it all tends to pack down pretty small.
And do you kind of lean on the sandwich idea a lot?
No, trying to get away from it, actually. I mean, because it's so cold recently, I've been doing a lot of soups, kind of making different breads. You want to take something that will fill you up and doesn't weigh too much, but you can get creative with it, really. So recently I've done a celeriac and apple soup and a roasted tomato and fennel, Mexican corn soups, all are kind of blended because it's just easier to eat.
Have you ever been on a hike where you're able to forage and make up something on the spot?
Definitely forage. Making things up on the spot is a little more difficult because you need to wash them. Last fall was very good for that. I found loads of blackberries and so ate plenty on the spot and then packed them up and made things like blackberry and polenta muffins and smoothies and brought them all home. And then also in England, there's something called sloes, which are small, dusky, hard purple berries. And you use those to flavor gin here. So I've just finished making a batch.
So that's where the name sloe, S-L-O-E, gin comes from.
It is exactly where it comes from. And if you live in England, you can find them in hedgerows.
Wow, I never knew that. And what is the flavor like?
They're very bitter on their own. And then once you steep them in gin and add fair amounts of sugar, it's a bit like maybe kind of a raspberry, blackberry, red currant kind of flavor.
Wow, how marvelous. Do you have a recipe you could share with us for trail mix?
Yes, I would love to share my recipe for trail mix with you. I have a marmalade granola I make, and then I like to mix things like dark chocolate-covered cranberries, crystallized ginger, yogurt-covered raisins, and lots of different nuts with it. That's the secret. The thing about cooking for picnics is it has to be sturdy and easily transported. So it sounds very basic, but it's all about how you package things and contain them.
And what do you use as the matrix that you use to flavor the original mixture of oats and seeds that you must use?
Yeah, I use marmalade. You have to heat marmalade and maple syrup and oil and cinnamon until you make nice, it all combines, because obviously the marmalade needs to be melted down a bit. And then you just put that on a mixture of oats and nuts and bake it for a little while.
Do you usually use orange marmalade, or do you tend to go afield?
Well, I've been thinking about this recently. I tend to go with orange because I think it goes best with lots of flavors, but I'd really like to try lime or grapefruit marmalade sometime in the near future.
How far out of London do you have to travel for good hiking?
Well, the great thing about living in London is it's not like America where there's lots of urban sprawl. There are lots of different places. They're very green and very accessible, and there are so many trains to get out of London to them. So within 45-minute train ride, you can be in the middle of the country and not see anyone for hours.
You're so lucky. Well, thank you so much, Kate. It's been wonderful.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Kate Perutz. Her blog is The Saturday Picnic Society. I'd love to hear your picnic food ideas. Go ahead and share them with us on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Jonathan Gold's here with me now. He is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and each week he joins us here on Good Food to tell us where to eat. Today we're venturing to Culver City, and yes, there will be kale.
We're going to the restaurant with the infelicitous name Muddy Leek.
You think it's infelicitous?
I think it's the kind of name that a Monty Python character would make up if he was making up the name of a restaurant
in the
skit.
That's true.
We're going down to the Muddy Leek.
Are there a lot of leeks on the menu?
There are some leeks. I'd say the signature dish is probably a dish of melted leeks with a fried egg on top.
Oh, that sounds actually delicious.
It kind of is. Leeks and egg and polenta underneath.
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
Also kale. You can't have anything these days without kale.
Part of me feels like the health department won't give you an A unless you have kale.
Probably not. Or poached eggs on miscellaneous dishes.
Oh, my goodness. Many poached eggs. That's the fault of the sous vide. Now that we finally figured out how to keep those poached eggs perfectly, it's really hard not to do that, I would imagine, for a young chef.
I've been to restaurants where neither I nor anybody in my party ordered anything that was an egg dish, where the number of eggs that was served went well into the double figures.
Okay, so let's move on past the egg yolks. What did you have that you enjoyed at Muddy Leek?
The food there is really simple, right? So if you're going to get scallops, they're simply seared. There's salt, pepper. There'll be maybe some braised fennel with it, a couple onions. That's it. You're not dealing with, oceans of beurre blanc. You're not dealing with gastriques.
In a way, it must be kind of a relief every once in a while to go to a simpler restaurant that has less complexity going on the plate.
Right. And it's very farmer's market oriented. I mean, you'll see the name of every farmer listed somewhere on the menu or on a chalkboard. And they're most of the farmers that we know and love. And sometimes it's nice to go and just get a big mushroom tart for dinner.
Oh, that actually sounds quite good.
Mushrooms, cream, a little bit of spinach, just enough black truffle to let you know that he's thinking in that direction without actually being enough to be overwhelming. And that's it. It's a simple dinner. You have that, have a little green salad, you're done. there's a nice vegetable risotto with, you know, little bits of, well, leeks. There'd have to be leeks, right? And mint and asparagus and tiny little turnips and pretty much what you'd buy at the farmer's market at the moment. And pickles. A restaurant is as incapable of opening without a pickle selection these days as it is without the kale. Someday somebody will pickle the kale and then... then that will be the great convergence and the world will end. There's a nice patio in back where you can go and sit. It's very relaxed. Sitting in the restaurant is actually fairly relaxed. You don't feel as if you're in some like Tinker Toy fanatic's idea of what a restaurant should be. You're just sitting down and having food and
Unpretentious.
People there tend to be from the neighborhood. Some of the restaurants that were there before tended to have a real sort of, you know, architect, designer crowd. And this one doesn't so much. It's dinner party food, but it's dinner party food that's pretty well done.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Muddy Leek on Washington Boulevard in Culver City. You can get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget to check out the Good Food Restaurant Map where you can find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations. Coming up, are we living in a foodopoly? How it came to be that just one company controls 90% of the soy milk market. Find out after this short break.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back to Good Food. I want you to imagine for a moment that you're at your local grocery store. Maybe it's a Ralph's, maybe it's a Walmart, or maybe even a natural food store. Now walk over to the dairy aisle and take a look. You're looking at a lot of different brands on the shelves. You see Altadena, Knudsen, Horizon Organic, Silk, Land of Lakes. They're all represented, right? Seemingly six different companies to choose from. But no, all of those brands, and many more, are run or licensed by just one company. Dean Foods controls 40% of the milk market and 90% of the soy milk market. This is what Winona Howder calls a foodopoly. She's the executive director of Food and Water Watch, and her new book explores the extreme consolidation of our food system. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, it's really our pleasure. So let's talk about consolidation. Who are the biggest winners these days in the consolidation wars of food business?
Well, I would say that the very biggest winners are the giant retail grocery stores, with Walmart at the top, followed by Kroger, Costco, and Target. These large grocery chains really dictate what kind of food is produced and how it's packaged and sold in this country. And they even can dictate to the largest food processing companies in the world. And those here in the United States, we have 20 companies that really dominate most of the brands that a consumer sees when they go into a grocery store. So I'm talking about Pepsi at the top, followed by Nestle, Kraft, Tyson, JBS, which is a giant meat company, General Mills, Dean, Mars, Smithfield, and Kellogg's. That's the top 10. And these are the companies that have gotten together with food scientists and been able to create recipes using fat, sugar, and salt that are actually addicting to consumers.
I think a lot of consumers would be surprised to know that the retail chains have so much power over the food processing industry. Can you give us an idea of how they're involved, what they ask of the processors?
Well, yes. And I want to say that changes in the grocery industry really began in the 1990s when the big store chains merged or bought out other regional retailers and the large warehouse clubs. And that's when Walmart began expanding into grocery products. And I think that Walmart's a really good example of how even the food processors have to listen to a big food chain like Walmart. What the company does is it continually puts pressure on the suppliers to cut costs. That means that to keep Walmart happy so that Walmart doesn't go to some other big food processor, the companies actually try to cut their costs. And that means that there's a shift taking place, a shift in costs downward. And in fact, these logistical operations mean that the cost of doing business goes to the supplier rather than the retailer. For instance, Walmart requires suppliers to adopt a supply chain management system, a logistics system, data sharing programs, and to even manage their own inventory. Even on the store shelves, the supplier has to go into the Walmart and make sure that there's inventory there. And Walmart was really the first company to bring this kind of high-tech information management into the grocery industry. The other thing is that contracts with Walmart, they're really non-negotiable. If a supplier like Nestle or Kraft wants to do business with the world's largest retailer, it basically has to accept their terms.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Winona Howder. She's the executive director of Food and Water Watch, and her new book is Foodopoly. How were they allowed to get so big?
It all happened in the Reagan administration. They started doing massive budget cuts. They got rid of whole departments. They actually allowed practices that had been against the law before to become legal, things like allowing large mergers between competitors. And probably even most important, they narrowed the definition of what an antitrust violation is.
The latest example of this, I would guess, would be the beer industry.
Right. Oh, we have had a flurry of mergers over the past few months. There are basically two brewers that control 80% of beer in the United States. So it looks like we have all of these different brands, but they're really controlled by these two foreign-owned companies. And this is having a distressing effect on microbreweries that can't get their beverages into grocery stores and convenience stores. And this very largest of the companies that wants to acquire the Mexican company that owns Corona, they want to buy Corona because Corona has actually been competing with this company's products. And I'm talking about the company is Anheuser-Busch InBev. Corona has been competing with Bud Light. And then another giant merger was announced, and this is between Cargill and ConAgra's flour milling operations. This milling operation, which would be called Argent, would actually end up producing the flour for 1 out of 3 slices of bread.
You know, when I hear you speak about this level of consolidation on the processing side and the distribution side and on the retail side, I start to think about how there is an illusion of choice for the consumer in the marketplace. And how does this play into what capitalism is supposed to be?
Well, you know, I think that there is an illusion of choice, and we know that Americans love to have diversity and selection in brands. But what's happened is the owners of the brands have figured out how to do niche marketing. So it's all about dividing up the customer base into different small markets and then marketing a brand to them.
Thank you so much, Winona.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
That was Winona Hauter. She's the executive director of Food and Water Watch. We've been talking about her recent book, Foodopoly: The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Here's an ingredient that you are extremely unlikely to find in your local Walmart: micronized charcoal powder. It's a key ingredient in the lobster roll at David Meyer's new restaurant, Hinoki and the Bird. If you turn to the Google image page of said lobster roll, you will notice one thing immediately. The bun is jet black. You'll also notice that it's stuffed to the gills with a lobster salad that's been seasoned with Vietnamese green curry. The dish as a whole is a collaboration between Myers and his executive chef, Kuniko Yagi. It's great to have both of you here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Congratulations on the new restaurant.
Thank you.
I'm really interested in how chefs who work together collaborate.
Collaboration is always a fun thing.
And is it common?
You know, it's, I don't think it was as common as it is now. Back when I was coming up, the chef really, you know, laid out the plan and laid out the dishes. And maybe his chef de cuisine would work a little bit on some of the ideas, but not really.
And presenting those ideas to the executive chef would be somewhat fraught with crossing a line.
Yes, because it was really the chef's, you know, baby, his restaurant. So you had to, you were there for them.
What do you think changed that now collaboration seems to be much more normal?
Well, I think a lot of young talent now don't necessarily want to just be dictated to. They want to share ideas. They want to showcase or show that their talents, contribute in a much more meaningful way than, say, in the past. You know, I think it's great because you get the best of everybody. You start to pull everybody in and they buy into the vision of the restaurant. And, you start to get a lot of incredible ideas.
So let's talk about this lobster roll. You obviously wanted to make a lobster roll, and there are quite a few in town. So what did you have an initial idea of what direction you wanted to go in?
Yeah, you know, the Pearl from New York down in the Village, you know, one of my favorite places to get a lobster roll, it really inspired me to come up with something different. Their lobster roll is classic. It's amazing, and nothing needs to change about that. But at Hinoki and the Bird, you know, obviously it was about an exploration and travel and you know, having the Silk Road kind of be the guide. So when Chef Cooney and I were coming up with these, you know, bantering back and forth over how we could make this lobster roll really spectacular, she came up with the idea of not only bringing in the Vietnamese green curry component, but also adding the charcoal powder from Japan into the bun, because, you know, the bun is a critical component of this dish. It's got to have the right texture and everything. So she came up with that idea.
So, Cooney, tell me a little bit about this black bun. You know, it's interesting because so many young chefs these days are playing with char and charring things quite deeply. This just looks charred, but it's a soft, beautiful roll.
We wanted to have our lobster roll to have some impact, like visually as well. So this is for color, and you don't taste charred and smoked or bitter much. It's the visual that you get wow to.
What is the ingredient that gives it that incredible color?
It's a charcoal powder. It's micro-refined, so you don't get the texture of, like, you're eating charcoal.
Does it have charcoal-like properties?
So this is for health. Like, you can digest stuff better, and it's a cleansing of your body and eliminate the odor.
I love that. So while you're eating this lobster in a great green curry, you're also cleaning your system.
Right.
Perfect. Do you know if it comes from a particular kind of wood?
Yes. Bamboo, actually.
Oh.
From their own prefecture. Nara has tons of bamboo. You're the first one to ask.
Really?
Yes.
So do you just add it into flour?
Yes, we do add the powder into the dough when we are kneading.
Oh, and do you knead very much?
It's very tiny amount, very.
Give me an idea of proportions.
Let's say for like home cook amount, when you make 12 buns, you only need 1 teaspoon.
1 teaspoon?
Yes.
Wow, I love that. I'm just blown away by that concentration.
Right.
Once the roll is baked, does it give you a look of matte black or is it shiny?
Matte.
It looks like it was found in nature.
Like a log.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the inside. I understand that amongst lobster roll fans, there are two camps, the mayonnaise camp and the butter and the butter camp. Where in that debate does your lobster roll fit?
I like them both. I think if you can add both of them, I think it's great. You know, butter the bun and add mayonnaise to the lobster itself. But we make an aioli with ours, and we fold in our Vietnamese green curry to it. And then we do brush the bun with clarified butter, so you get the best of both worlds.
Wow.
You don't have to go without with us.
Now, these days, it seems in the food eating world that there's not much we have to go without. Describe the Vietnamese green curry as opposed to, let's say, a Thai green curry.
So to me, I think the there's a heat difference, for one. On the Thai green curry, there's a lot more predominant spice, and by spice, I mean heat. On the Vietnamese, it's definitely backed off. There's a lot more bright flavors that come through, a little bit sweeter. But there is, you know, an underlying heat note to it, but it's just like a little hum as opposed to, you know, a bark. To me, it covers a whole spectrum of flavors that are enhanced then by the Thai basil blossoms that we add to the top to give it that sort of fresh licorice punch.
Oh, I love that. And also, I have to say, looking at photographs of it, that's a nice roll. It's like really stuffed.
Yeah, no, you have to. You know, lobster roll, and I learned this from the Pearl, you got to be generous. And, you know, you charge accordingly because, you know, nobody wants a two-bite little thing of lobster. I mean, you really want copious amounts of lobster in it. And, you know, it's an expensive but luxurious bite.
Is it considered an appetizer on your menu?
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, absolutely. The whole concept there is about sharing anyway, or drinking food for that matter. That's why I love, you know, eating all throughout Asia, because it's really just, you know, stop at one place and move on to the next with another drink, and it's just fun. But, you know, this one is definitely considered an appetizer, although we had somebody last night order it as a main course.
Two?
They had one as an app, and then they had another one as a main course.
The best compliment you could ever have, right?
Yeah, no, it was so nice.
It's like, I don't want to give up that flavor. I'm not moving on. I'm just
really
staying
nice
with it. That's sort of like the opposite of the small plate.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, both of you, for
Thank
coming.
You.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Evan.
That was David Myers, chef and founder of Hinoki and the Bird, along with his executive chef, Kuniko Yagi. Check out a video of Kuniko making the lobster roll on the Good Food blog. Trust me, you'll want to check it out. This is no ordinary lobster roll. Now that the weather's warming up, it's time to start planting our edible gardens. Coming up next, I've got a pro in the studio to talk about seeds, and you might be really shocked by what she has to say. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. If you've ever grown a tomato, you know the power of a seed. That incredible source of germplasm that comes to fruition as a prolific food-bearing plant. It's such a powerhouse, that tiny little seed, and as worthy of our attention as the food it creates. But in her recent opinion piece for the New York Times, Margaret Roach writes that, quote, all seed is not created equal, unquote. A vegetarian for over 35 years, Margaret was the first garden editor for Martha Stewart Living. Her latest book is The Backyard Parables, Lessons on Gardening and Life. Could you explain, first of all, how seeds are grown? How different is it to be a seed grower rather than a fruit or vegetable or plant grower?
Well, it's interesting because even as long as I've gardened, which is probably 30 years, and as sort of semi-expert as I probably am relative to when I began, I didn't really have this aha until the last few years. Of course, it makes sense when you think about it. If I want to grow broccoli or lettuce or another such crop to eat in my vegetable garden, if I want baby mesclun, for instance, I might sow the seed in my raised bed and I might harvest it 3 or 4 weeks later. And broccoli, you know, it would be in for a couple of months. But if I wanted to get seed from those crops, of course, what has to happen to get seed is you have to go through sexual reproduction. You have to flower and then set seed. So that means the plant is older. And so the more time in the ground for that seed farmer has to grow that right through the complete life cycle of the plant to quite an old age for a plant. And that means the possibility of encountering all kinds of challenges, additional challenges that don't happen when you just grow it for its vegetative, you know, for its leaves or its, you know, with the case of the broccoli, the beginning of the flowering stage, but not later on. So it's a lot bigger investment of time and a lot more problems that can be encountered.
Because there must be a much greater pressure from pests and potential fungus.
Yes. You know, each year will present different challenges. And so when you want to grow this plant through its whole life cycle, and by the way, a lot of vegetables that we eat and we count on, you know, onions and celery and carrots and beets and chard and cabbage and cauliflowers and a lot of others are biennials. So they don't even set seed until the second year in the ground. And there's some pests and pathogens that just appear at the flowering stage, and some pathogens that only appear as a problem for seeds, so that late in the life of the plant. So different fungicide and pesticide applications are permitted, and it's state by state, crop by crop, year by year, according to the pressures encountered. They are permitted additional amounts for these non-food crops of these vegetables, in other words, producing seed, not vegetables for the supermarket.
But in addition to just the pesticide load on the seed itself, does that mean that if you're a gardener and you're striving to maybe not be perfectly organic, but you're striving in your own home garden to use as few inputs as possible, that using a conventional seed maybe isn't the best place for you to start, that it will give you challenges that you don't foresee?
And this is what's really important and not political, you know, because there's two sides to all the politics and the environmental points of view on this. But here's where it gets much more practical for the gardener, because plants, like any organisms, adapt to the conditions that they live in, especially over multiple generations. So matching your seed source to your the way that your seed was farmed over the generations that farmer has been producing that seed, the way he or she grows it, where they grow it, the conditions that it's grown in, matching that to your conditions at home as closely as is possible is going to give you the best result because of adaptation. So I am an organic gardener. I mean, I don't have a certified organic garden, but I don't use chemicals in my home garden. And I'd like to have seed that is grown with low inputs like that so that when it comes to me, it doesn't expect me to coddle it. So I don't want to contribute to upstream pollution, to the pollution produced on a conventional seed farm, nor do I want a seed to arrive at my garden expecting this extra TLC in the form of chemicals.
So, you know, for example, I'm a Southern California gardener. Would it behoove me to look for seed sources where the seeds are grown out in California?
I like to match, as I said, as closely as possible. So if I were growing in Southern California, I would probably want to be buying my seed from a place where it was accustomed to lower rainfall, generally warmer climates than, say, where my seed, I'm in the Northeast, I might like to buy my seed somewhere that's more acclimated to the way the weather is where I am. It doesn't mean necessarily right in my neighborhood, but as close as possible.
It's so interesting because, you know, I've never thought about that before.
It was the old way. Think about how agriculture worked and gardening as an extension of agriculture. How was seed produced? You know, when you go back to the pre-World War II and earlier, people grew their crops. They were open-pollinated, non-hybrid, in other words, crops. They saved their seed, or they got it locally, nearby. They didn't, you know, it wasn't a big international agribusiness type of, you know, run by six transnational corporations like it is now. So seed was very locally adapted by nature of the fact that a farmer or a gardener grew his crops and saved his or her own seed.
So let's talk for a minute about the seduction of seeds. Every year, when seed catalogs start to arrive at my house, you look at all of these packets and you just want to buy everything. How long do seeds last?
Well, there's two things. There's viability and vigor to consider. Viability means literally that the seed will germinate, but it may not have a lot of vigor left after a couple of years. Some things, such as onion seed, last maybe a year at most. They're very perishable. Parsley's pretty perishable. On average, things last a couple or a few years if stored correctly, some a little longer, some shorter. They are definitely perishable. They're live. They're embryos. It's the most beautiful thing when you think about that little creature curled up inside there, waiting for the right moment to be invited out to grow, you know, some moisture, some warmth, and a medium to set its roots down into. It's kind of exciting.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
It's so nice to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. That was Margaret Roach. We've been talking about seeds. Her blog is awaytogarden.com, and her book is called Backyard Parables, Lessons on Gardening and Life. Hear the unedited version of our conversation on the Good Food blog. I have to say that listening to Margaret Roach and Winona Howder, I can't help but think that we're at a real turning point right now. On one hand, we see massive consolidation and a seeming lack of transparency, right? But on the other hand, we see a rapidly growing interest in knowing exactly where our food comes from and how it's made. Now, one way consumers are directly engaging with food producers is through CSAs, or community-supported agriculture. The idea is that you pay up front for a predetermined share of a farmer's crop. Mostly, it's done with fruit and vegetables, but my next guest is doing it with grain. Ben Lester is the owner of Wheatberry Cafe and Bakery and the brains behind Pioneer Valley Heritage Grain. It's a grain and bean CSA out of Amherst, Massachusetts. How did you get started with this idea of a CSA grain movement?
Well, it was sort of a combination of two events. One is our sort of involvement with vegetable CSAs as members and meat CSAs out here as well. So a lot of our sort of home diet has been coming direct from farms through CSA programs. And then in 2008, commodity grain prices across the globe tripled and quadrupled overnight. So we started looking into the possibility of creating a closer-to-home source for grains. And, you know, over the course of a few months and looking into what the, you know, costs were going to be, what was going to be involved in the process, who would grow the grains, and then how we would process them maybe at the bakery and make them for sale, it clicked together. And we said, wait a second, why not go direct to consumer and take out the, you know, the convenience aspect, but, you know, one of the expensive aspects of, you know, having someone do all the baking and making of the products and just get it right into the hands of the most interested consumers.
How many farmers are you working with now, and how many different grains are available through the CSA?
Yeah, so at this point, I think we work with about four or five different farms. You know, one of our farmers grows six or seven different types, and he's sort of one of our main growers, gentleman Alan Zukowski in Hadley. And so he grows spelt and rye and usually a couple different types of wheat. He's been a specialty sweet corn grower for many years, and so he really liked the idea of growing some grain corn. And so we have this wonderful selection of grain corns. And most people, I think, are only very vaguely familiar with the device diversity that's available in the world of corn, but it's a very, there's lots of different types of corn. There's flint corn and there's dent corn, there's blue corns, there's green corns, there's very soft corn, and ones that are better suited to grits and polenta, and some are better suited to making traditional masa or, tortillas and tamales out of masa. So this year he has about five different varieties.
How does the CSA process work? How often do the participants receive their shares, and what kind of grain are they receiving?
Yeah, so as well as, the four or five different things that Alan grows, we work with several other farmers who are growing things like buckwheat and dry beans, pinto, black beans, red kidney beans, and sometimes we're able to source things like emmer, which is a very ancient wheat. A share on a given year is going to have about 10 different crops usually. 8 to 12 is kind of the range. It's a once-a-year pickup. That's maybe sort of the biggest difference between a grain CSA and a vegetable CSA or even a meat CSA. And so it's really, it's quite a party and sort of celebration of those of us who are going, the extra mile and, really want to make our food as genuine and delicious, and we're willing to deal with grains in their whole form, which, Americans haven't done much of for the past 100 years or so.
So your CSA members do not receive the grain already milled. They have to mill it themselves. Correct.
Yeah. And that's a really important feature of the CSA, because once you mill a whole berry of grain, unless you germ it, it has a pretty limited shelf life. These whole grains represent another, whole additional culinary palette of flavors and textures cooked whole. So a lot of the membership, I'd guess that maybe 30 to 40% is ground for flour, and probably 70% of the share is cooked and eaten whole. And some of that's in the form of dry beans, about 20 to 30% of the share is dry beans. But a lot of the wheat and the rye and the spelt and the emmer in particular is very good, are wonderful alternatives to rice or pasta, just cooked whole.
Now, I'm really curious about the milling aspect. Are people sharing home mills? Do you have a place where people can visit to mill their own if they want?
We do. We have a self-service milling station at our restaurant, which is open 7 days a week. There's a stone mill, and there's also a couple different flaking devices for rolling oats or rolling spelt or making muesli. And it's a very easy-to-use small stone mill, and many of our members come in and grind their grain as they need, and a lot of them own mills at their house. They're widely available and really quite affordable. You can spend anywhere from $60 to hundreds of dollars on mills, but certainly there are very good options. In the range of a couple $100s. That's been, I think, one of the other really exciting discoveries is that fresh really is best, whether you're talking lettuce or wheat berries.
How do people store the grain when they're whole and in their unmilled state?
Very, very simply, and this is a really common question. It's one of the, first questions I get from people who are considering buying a share. And the answer is that it's extremely easy to store small amounts of grain, like the quantities we get in the share. So, a full share being about 115 pounds and a half share being about 55 or 60 pounds. Because they're whole, they're very stable. It's only when you start milling them that the germ becomes prone to rancidity. So the seed, the whole berries will keep sort of indefinitely with reasonably cool, dry storage, and certainly, cool being even, 70 or 75 degrees, and dry being anything under than, 80 or 90% humidity. I mean, eventually, if you have too much heat and too much moisture with any food, it will spoil. Grains are certainly, prone to that. But, in your average kitchen cupboard, they will keep indefinitely for years.
Well, thank you so much, Ben. It's been fascinating.
Absolutely. It was lovely to talk with you. Take care now.
That was Ben Lester. We've been talking about a community-supported grain and bean CSA he runs called Pioneer Valley Heritage Grain. Don't go away. I've got more good food coming up after this short break.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. It's a controversial process by which thousands of gallons of water, chemicals, and sand are injected into the ground with enormous pressure. This is all in an effort to release and capture natural gas from underground shales. Supporters believe that natural gas adds jobs, and it also reduces our dependence on oil. But critics cite environmental risks and the lack of scientific studies as causes for concern. There's been a lot of discussion about the effects of fracking on nearby water sources, but a recent article draws attention to the effects of fracking on farming. Elizabeth Royt is best known for her books Garbage Land and Bottle Mania. She turns her investigative eye to food in her recent article, Fracking Our Food Supply.
I wrote my story about the potential impacts of fracking on the food supply because farmers, as the largest private landholders in the country, are disproportionately approached by oil and gas companies to drill on their land. And some of these farmers are starting to see some impacts they think that are linked with air emissions and water contamination. And I based my reporting on a paper published by Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald, who work out of Ithaca, New York. And they started collecting case stories from a little bit more than 2,000 farmers and ranchers who had lost livestock after they'd been incidentally or accidentally exposed to chemicals used in drilling and fracking. They collected these stories. They looked at the history of the animals, what their lives had been like before fracking started, and then what was going on afterward. And they were finding that animals lost large amounts of weight really quickly. I talked to a farmer whose cattle dropped 60 to 80 pounds in a week. They had infections all over their bodies. They were limping. They would die of pulmonary edema. They had respiratory failure. These cows would quit feeding their babies. The woman I spoke to for my story, five of her cows lost the bottom half of their tails. They didn't lose their whole tails, but their tails dropped off at the end. So the paper reported on more than 100 cattle deaths and then scores of other deaths of goats and sheep and chickens. If animals didn't die, many of them who were pregnant gave birth to, they had stillbirths or their babies had birth defects. So there were some serious trickle-down effects, even if the cows made it through their exposures.
Now, you talked at the beginning of your explanation about the livestock about incidental or accidental exposure. What would characterize those?
An accidental exposure would be a waste pit containing fracking fluid overflowing because of a heavy rain or because a liner in the pit was torn. Incidental exposures would be breathing in exhaust fumes from pipelines or flanges or venting or trucks and all the heavy equipment that's on these well pads. And the accidents are more of the spills and the dumping and the direct contact with fluids.
It would seem kind of common sense that the humans near the livestock would also experience these incidents and accidents.
Some of them have, and you hear a lot of stories in the media about people having nosebleeds and rashes, and some of these farmers had these as well, but in the general population, in heavily fracked areas, people without livestock, you hear about headaches and vomiting and diarrhea, and people can't explain it, but people get to go indoors and close their windows, and people go to work or they go to the supermarket, and they get a break from a lot of these emissions. And they may be drinking bottled water if they're suspicious about their water quality. But the point that these researchers made in their paper is that animals make good sentinels for people because they are outdoors all day long, breathing this air 24 hours. They eat a lot more food and they drink a lot more water. So they have these multiple pathways of exposure that are much longer than ours. And they have faster reproductive cycles so that when you have these birth defects, for example, you'll see them a lot sooner than waiting for, you know, a human female to get pregnant and have a baby. So that's why people like to look at animals, so they see effects sooner.
So given that they're acting as sentinels, is there starting to be concern that some of these same areas where there is a lot of this type of drilling going on is where a lot of our wheat is grown and a lot of other major agricultural crops?
People are thinking about it, but nobody really knows. These studies have not been conducted. They suggest a link, but no one has been able to prove cause and effect, and there are a lot of reasons for this. And one is that we don't know exactly what these chemicals are because the oil and gas industry isn't required to disclose all of their chemicals and what amounts and concentrations. They voluntarily disclose some of them on a website, but they don't need to do it before they begin a fracking job. And so it's almost impossible for a landowner to do pre-drilling tests of their soil or their air or their water. And if you don't have those data, you can't make a comparison before operations started to after operations. So it's hard to say everything was fine and then you guys did this and now these chemicals are showing up here. And these studies haven't been done because they're really expensive and they take a long time, many, many years. And they're really complicated because there's so many chemicals involved and they interact with each other and they interact with chemicals that are already in the environment. And so you have multiple pathways, air, water, soil. You've got chemicals moving through plants into animals. Are they accumulating? Are the plants taking up, you know, a myriad of chemicals? And if they are, do they then move into the animal? And if they do move into the animal, do they go into the parts that we eat? And is it at levels that could hurt us?
Now, traditionally, often dairy cows will find their way into the meat system after their usefulness as a milking animal has ended. Is there a system for making sure that some of these animals that have been ill don't make it into the food supply?
Well, we know that animals that die on the farm don't go into the system, but herd mates that are exposed to many of the same chemicals and contaminants that appear healthy go on to slaughterhouses. The departments of ag in the states that I looked at are not testing for the residues of drilling and fracking operations in milk, and slaughterhouses aren't required to look for those contaminants in the meat that they're looking at either.
That was Elizabeth Reut. We've been discussing her recent article, Fracking Our Food Supply, that was published in The Nation. Find a link to the full article on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Lara Garcia and Sarah Rogozin are our segment producers, and our executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. Come back next week. I'll be here doing another edition of Good Food.